We up? Okay, we'll go ahead and call the meeting to order, and the clerk will take the roll.
Vice Chair Keenan.
Present.
Representative Beatty.
Here.
Representative Binkley.
Here.
Vice Chair Cafaro.
Excuse me.
Representative Kirk Carpenter.
Here.
Representative Falk.
Excused.
Representative Fitzpatrick.
Excused. He was also.
Representative Gillette.
Excused.
Representative Hamilton.
Here.
Representative Hastings.
Here.
Representative Hellegarde.
Here.
Representative Hopkins.
Here.
Representative Keough.
Barely.
Representative Mercer.
Excused.
Representative Moore.
Here.
Representative Nave.
Here.
Representative Stuart Paraguay.
Here.
Representative Reed.
Excused.
Representative Regeer.
Excused.
Representative Schillinger.
Here.
Representative Tuss.
Excused.
Excuse.
Representative Windy Boy.
Excuse.
Chair Jones.
Here, and Representative Regeer just walked in. So with a quorum present, we are ready to do business. Two bills to hear, several executive actions. We are going to get started here with Senate Bill 124. Senator.
Turn that on. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Greg Hertz, Senate District 6 out of Polson. Mr. Chair, I've got handouts. May I distribute these? Absolutely. So today, while the handout's going around, I'll kind of talk about what this bill is about. And so this bill only deals with multi-state C corporations. So, and so that, you know, that's a corporation doing business in multiple states. And decades ago, you know, the country was struggling with how do we tax fairly these corporations that do business in different states. So if you kind of think of it as a big pie, this company's got their taxable income pie. And then, so we wanted to fairly make sure that each state is taxing their fair share and that no state's going to be taxing more. So the states enter into this multi-state tax compact, which basically looked at three factors. It was, how much sales do you do in that state? How much property do you have in that state? And what's your payroll in that state? So they added those three factors together as a percentage of the total company and divided by three. And, you know, if that came up to Montana, you represent 15% of that factor, you get to take 15% of the pie. Idaho, if you get 25%, you get 25% of the pie. So basically the pie gets divided up and by 100%, and everybody gets to tax their fair share. So over time, though, states have wandered away from that agreement. And now the vast majority of states are using one factor, and that's the single sales factor. So whatever percentage your sales represent in that state, that's the portion of taxable income that you can tax. However, there's still those of us, like I think there might be eight of us, who are still using multi-state factors. So the handout that you have, I'm going to walk you through this so you can kind of see three different companies and how this might impact. So on page one of the handout, you got company number one selling into Montana. And so basically, if you look on the left-hand column, 10% of their sales are coming into Montana, $100,000. So right now, last session, we passed a bill that you had to use twice the sales factor. So it's listed twice. But in this case, only 1.79% of their payroll is in Montana, and 0.67% of their property is in Montana. Add up all those factors, divide by four. So 5.61% of the multi-state using this formula, we can grab that portion of their taxable income. So let's say they had $2.5 million of taxable income. We can tax $140,000 of that taxable income. The what would happen with a single sales factor? Well, 10% of their sales are into Montana, so we would tax $250,000 of their taxable income because 10% of their sales are in Montana. So let's go to page two. You got a company, they got employees in Montana. lot of employees in Montana, but they're selling outside of Montana. So you think like a manufacturing plant in Montana that's doing a lot of manufacturing here, whether it's software or other companies, but most of their products going out of state. So 10% of their sales are in Montana. We double that up under current law. But 92% of their employees are right here in the state of Montana. 93% of their property is in Montana. Divide all that up, 51% of their factors are here. So we get to tax 51% of their income, $2.5 million, $1.2 million. But let's say that company does business in other states that are using the single sales factor. So you go down below, and Montana may be taxing 50% of it, but these other states want to grab the other 90% of that taxable income because they're using one factor. So now all of a sudden this Montana company is paying more than their fair share to the different states. So they're paying $2.2 million on their taxable income in the other states plus $1.2 million. So now all of a sudden they're paying tax on more than their income in multiple states. If you go over to the right side of the column, if we have the single sales factor like these other states, they'd only be paying tax on 10% of their states. So why is this important for these particular companies in Montana? So you look at what these companies are contributing to Montana. They have a lot of employees in this state. They're being paid very well. They're living in the community. They're paying property taxes. They're also paying income taxes. So this is the type of company that we want in Montana. And that company has most of their property here, so they are also paying property taxes in this state. But those other companies that are just flying goods into the state, they're not sharing in that tax burden. Also, this company, I'll guarantee you, this company is helping out their community. They're making donations to the schools, the Little League teams, and everything else that the Montana businesses do in our state. So if you go to the very last page, you have employees in Montana and selling in Montana. So this is a company, and you know, I am a multi-state corporation, so this kind of reflects what I do. So 90% of my sales are in Montana, 92% of my payroll's in Montana, and 93% of my property's in Montana. So 91% of my taxable income gets taxed in Montana. If we went to the multi-state sales factor, only 90%. So it's not going to benefit businesses like me that live here, work here. Most of the sales are here, and we may have one other location outside the state. So that's not what we're doing. So what this bill is trying to do, we're trying to incentivize companies to come to Montana, set up shop, but we want you to bring all your employees here and all your payroll here. I mean, if you could think of a company like a beef processing facility, that would be great for Montana. It would help our farmers and ranchers. It'd all be processed here, but most of those sales, because we only have 1 million-plus people in Montana, would be going outside the state. But it would really benefit our state to do something like that. An ammunition manufacturer, a gun manufacturer, software manufacturers. We want those businesses here bringing their good paying jobs to the state of Montana. What we also want is to make sure that these people who do not work, don't have a lot of employees here and a lot of property here, who are selling into Montana. And we all know who those people are. Currently, right now, we're not collecting their fair share of taxes because our multi-apportionment, they don't have a lot of employees here and they don't have a lot of property here, so they kind of get the benefit of that. They're coming in here and they're taking business away from many of our Main Street businesses. So if they're going to do that, they need to come, they need to pay their fair share of taxes to the state, and so the other existing companies, whether they're multi-state or other folks, don't have to pick that up here in Montana. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think I've about covered, and I hope everybody understands multi-state. This, as you look at the fiscal note, this will raise some revenue. And where it's raising revenue is on those multi-state corporations that I just talked about who are sending products into the state. Their taxes are going to go up. The people who are here and selling outside the state, their taxes will go down. And those of us, like myself, ours aren't going to change hardly anything at all. But this is really a good benefit to the state of Montana and our businesses of Montana. So I request a due pass, Mr. Chair, and I'll listen to proponents and opponents.
Are there proponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Derek Bell, B-E-L-L. I'm the Department of Revenue's Division Administrator for its Business and Income Tax Division. Here on behalf of the Governor's Office and the agency in support of Senate Bill 124. With your permission, I also have a handout.
Certainly, sir.
The sponsor did a great job of articulating what this bill does and what it doesn't do, and I'm not going to repeat what he already indicated, but I just want to make a couple of key points. Senate Bill 124, when dealing with the apportionment of multi-state or multinational income, this does not affect purely Montana businesses. If the Montana business is 100% in Montana, this bill has no effect on that business, only multi-state income. The single sales factor that Senate Bill 124 is a better reflection of how multi-state businesses generate income today versus 50 or 60 years ago when the original three-factor formula was adopted by many states, including Montana. In addition to that, it promotes uniformity among the states. Most states that apportion multi-state or multinational income use a single sales factor. Uniformity is important for purposes of how we administer the law, but also for purposes of how multi-state taxpayers comply with the law. And moreover, as the sponsor indicated, Senate Bill 124 incentivizes these multi-state businesses to invest in people and property in the state of Montana. Here to answer any questions, if you have any, thank you very much.
Additional proponents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob Story, STORY, Montana Taxpayers Association. We also support the bill. I think the main point that the sponsor made, and we just want to reinforce it on the fiscal note, is that many Montana corporations will receive tax reductions under this apportionment methodology, and many that are not Montana-based corporations will pay more taxes, and that generates a positive fiscal note.
Additional proponents.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Wade, WADE, here on behalf of BNSF Railway. We're here today because last session, when this idea of moving to single sales factor came, we had some significant concerns, and as a result, as you heard before, the bill that was passed last time went to double-weighted sales. We appreciate the department in the interim working with us to address our concerns. As a result, we're here as a proponent moving forward for the Senate Bill 124. In addition, the Montana Chamber of Commerce would also like to convey their support for Senate Bill 124 as well.
Okay, additional proponents. Proponents online, I see none. Opponents. Opponents online, I see none. Informational witnesses.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Finn McMichael, MCM, ICH, AEL, the Department of Revenue, available for any questions on the fiscal note if you have any.
Thank you. Additional informational. Seeing none, questions from the committee. Representative Kirk Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a question either for the sponsor or for Mr. Bell. We'll start with the sponsor.
Senator.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator. I'm curious, I know that corporate income, or when we tax corporations, there tends to be a lot of volatility, and I'm just curious with this new formula, what kind of volatility are we putting into our revenues?
Mr. Chair, Representative, corporate income does kind of go up and down. So, that's probably a very difficult question to answer, whether it will impact it positively or negative. I just can't say. So,
you want to redirect on that?
Yeah, I wonder if Mr. Bell would have an answer of any sort of volatility that we can expect with this. Okay, I'm seeing him shake his head.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kirk Carpenter, there was a lot of head shaking this direction as I walked up to the podium. I'd like to sponsor, I don't really have a good answer on any volatility. I think, you know, we're looking at the overall, as the sponsor indicated, think of worldwide or domestic income as a pie. He uses a pie. I talk about a pizza. You can use whatever food analogy you like to use at 9 o'clock in the morning. And so I'm not sure the formula really doesn't add volatility to or from it. It's really the income that's where the volatility may lie, right? And so the formula could be, it's pretty it's standardized, so it's their sales into Montana versus the sales occurring outside everywhere else. So I think the volatility may lie at the taxable income component of the thing that this bill does not address.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, one more follow-up. Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Bell, I'm wondering how many other states have gone to this formula?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kirk Carpenter, my off-the-cuff answer is over 30. And it's, again, the vast majority of states that apportion multi-state or multinational income use a single sales factor. You're welcome.
Okay, additional questions? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Mr. Wade to begin with.
Mr. Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Wade, when I look at the sponsors' little examples here of different companies, I'm wondering why would you, what were the objections previously to doing this and how did those get resolved?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, I don't have that in front of me, but last session, I think one of the things you have to understand, there are a number of industries because of the way that they operate in other states and in Montana. They have certain rules, special rules. Those industries then, depending on how those rules are formulated, would have been impacted by how a single sales factor bill would have been drafted. And so what we were able to do was work with the department, as we've done in other states, and kind of transition those special rules for our industry into aligning with the single sales factor. So that's what we did in the interim. Wouldn't have been able to do in the short period of time last session. We did that in the interim, and that's why we're here, and we're basically now aligned with the concept of the bill.
Thank you. Question for the sponsor, Mr. Chair.
For the sponsor.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Chair and Senator, why the delayed starting date? Why does that start not till 25, tax year 25?
Mr. Chair, Representative, thanks for the question. Yeah, you'll notice two fiscal notes. The only reason is we delayed the start date. So when I bring bills to cut taxes, I like to make them effective as soon as possible. However, when you're increasing taxes on certain types of industries, I think it's only fair to them that you give them an opportunity to readjust their business model or whatever they may need to do to absorb the additional taxes they may have to pay. So that was the reason for delaying the effective date. It delays the additional revenue, what we may collect just for 1 year.
Thank you. Follow-up. Mr. Chair and Senator, can you explain the impact on pass-through entities when you have members scattered all over creation?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative, this only impacts C corporations. It does not impact pass-through entities, only C corps.
Follow-up?
Yes.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the fiscal note says that it does. I tried to find it in the bill, but couldn't find any mention of it in the bill, but it was a long bill. But do I have a, this is fiscal note 124.02, item number 3. And in fact, it then goes on items 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. All cover that. Well, 14 maybe doesn't. Oh, yes, it does.
Mr. Chair, Rep. Sam, may I redirect that to maybe Mr. Bell?
Redirect, Mr. Bell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton. I may also have to redirect this to Mr. McMichael.
Okay.
But the short answer that I can offer is that it has a limited or a very specific effect, and it's for pass-through entities that pay a composite tax. One of those entities that decide on behalf of its members to pay an entity-level tax, the composite tax, is one of the three ways that a pass-through entity can report its income to the state of Montana. There may be some implication there. There's a lot more nuance to it than I'm obviously describing. I'm happy to get you something more. Mr. McMichael might be able to describe it a little bit better than that, but that's the near, you know, the short term, the really short answer I can offer is that for those that pay a composite tax, it may have an effect on them. And it's really hard, as you saw on the fiscal note, for us to estimate what that even looks like. Because as you pointed out, the owners of these entities are scattered all over the place. And so I don't know that we have the ability to really estimate with any real precision how that, what that'll look like. But it has a, it could have a small effect.
Follow up. Mr. Chair and Mr. Bell, so I get the part about the composite tax return because that's paid at the entity level. But it, what is, I think what you're telling me is if they choose to pass through the taxable income to their members, then that doesn't affect that entity.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so if they elect to pay the composite tax and it's a multi-state organization, so I think that's the other piece of it, right? So if it's a multi-state business, you know, the composite tax only affects the non-resident owners of that entity, depending on even the number of tiers that it may have. And so if we're looking at the, how to apportion or allocate, apportion the multi-state income of that entity to Montana, and we're only using a single sales factor. So in statute, I think last session or two sessions ago, we you articulated that you moved, when we're looking at multi-state partnership or S-Corp activity, that they're relying upon the multi-state tax compact, which is what Senate Bill 124 does. So it would affect those. So if you had just sales into Montana versus everywhere, it would, that's the discrete type of entity that it would affect. And then that, that tax would then flow through, or that income would flow through to its non-resident owners.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to try also with Mr. McMichael. You did fine, but maybe he, I'll pick whatever.
I'm sure he can do better.
Whatever is his brain too.
Redirect a second time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton.
So the question is the same for, sorry, Mr. Chair, Mr. McMichael, the question is the same as for Mr. Bell. I get the idea of the composite tax one. I'm not sure I quite get it yet. If they pass through income to members and how it affects that kind of pass through entity.
Sure. Chair, Representative Hamilton, I think Mr. Bell did a pretty good job explaining it. So with pass throughs, the resident owners of pass-through entities pay tax on all of their income in Montana and then get credit for whatever taxes they pay in other states. Non-resident owners have to apply the apportionment factor for and pay only pay the taxes in Montana on whatever portion of their income. So that's where, in a simple sense, that's where this bill would impact the non-resident owners.
And follow up. Mr. Chair, Mr. McMichael, thank you. Well explained, I think. So I guess I would come to the fiscal note number 9, where it says it's significantly more complicated to estimate. And so perhaps it would be fair to say, and you can correct me if you're wrong, if I'm wrong, but that the impact on pass-through entities we should probably look at a little skeptically.
I would say that Mr. Chair, Representative, that the estimates for pass-throughs is less precise, there's less certainty in it than for C-Corps because we only have the information from the we're only specifically able to tie the apportionment factor for the pass-throughs to the income and estimate what that change would be for the ones paying the composite tax.
Okay. Final one, Mr. Chair.
Final question.
Mr. Chair, Mr. McMichael, I don't think you have this one, but I want to come back to the question on volatility and just check out a theory here with you. Because it's sales, employee wages, and property tax, we know property tax is very stable, and we know wages are a little more stable, but what we don't know is sales, I mean, what we believe, I think, is sales are much more volatile. And so given that those are the factors in there, if we're going simply to a sales version, I think we're increasing volatility over the left-hand side of the chart there. Would that be fair to say?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, I would agree with what Mr. Bell said earlier, that the majority of volatility in especially corporate income tax comes from the total taxable or the total taxable income and less so from the apportionment factors. The apportionment factors tend to be much more consistent year to year for the same individual company, and that's both for their sales and their other factors.
All right. Thank you.
Yep.
Any additional questions from the committee? Representative Mercer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a quick one for the sponsor.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mercer, Representative Mercer.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hertz, I wanted to pick back up on the effective date delay, and your reasoning made a lot of sense to me, and I just wanted to follow up and say, looks like as drafted, you were targeting the beginning of the new fiscal year, but then instead of sticking with sort of a fiscal year calendar, the amendment takes it to the end of, makes it effective essentially beginning 2025. And I wondered if, you know, I know your expertise in this area, which I really greatly appreciate. And I wondered if in your decision making, whether you thought about going to December 31st, 2023, which would have been more time than the bill drafted in its original form, and then in the alternative, whether you thought about going to June 30th, 2024, whether either of those alternatives were considered instead of going to the end of 2024, and essentially what went into your thought process there.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, mulled over all those different possibilities. One thing about corporations, a lot of them have fiscal year ends. A lot of them, probably more than calendar year ends. So when we're looking at having an effective date mid-year, you know, it kind of penalized some, helped others, and so then we just kind of went to, okay, let's just make this effective at the beginning of a calendar year, and you know, that was kind of where we fell down, just to do that, to make it a little more simpler.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
But, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hertz, but you didn't think that January 1, 2024 was enough time?
Mr. Chair, Representative, correct. In regard to that, that would capture some calendar year corporations and not give them enough time. It may give enough time for some fiscal people.
All right. Thank you, Senator Hertz.
Additional questions from the committee? Seeing none, if the sponsor would like to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hamblin, for educating me on my own bill. I had completely forgotten about those, you know, the composite tax. And getting to the composite tax, I don't think that will really impact any different than any other entity. You know, we're looking at the single sales factor and your question about volatility. Also, we're just going to be looking at sales. And so we're not going to, even whether it's a composite tax return or a C-Corp return, we are basically looking at sales. We're not going to penalize those folks in Montana who might even have a composite tax pass-through entity and have got a lot of employees here and businesses here. So that's the key focus of the bill. I hope everybody can support this bill and get it pushed out, and so that corporations in Montana and who want to come to Montana have a true signal from the Montana legislature. Our doors are open for business, and we want you to come here, bring your companies here, bring good jobs here, and help out our communities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, that ends the hearing, and we are on to House Bill 722. Speaker Regeer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Matt Regeer, that's R-E-G-I-E-R, representative for House District 4. So start out by stating the obvious that we are the Appropriations Committee. I think it's a big task that we have to appropriate for our great state. I think that responsibility should lie with us, and we shouldn't abdicate that to any other entity. There is another, however, appropriating committee, and that is the District Court Council. The District Court Council is made up of the Chief Justice and four District Court judges. There's four ex officio members, but they're non-voting. So five judges determine, and I'll read here from Montana Code 3-5-901, The Office of the Court Administrator shall fund all district court costs, including but not limited to salaries and benefits for district judges, law clerks, court reporters, probation officers, other employees, criminal cases, fees and transcripts, witness fees, and juror fees. So there is, I've talked to a few retired judges that described this court counsel as powerful. And I believe it is up to the Appropriations Committee and not five judges. I believe we need to have more transparency with Section D, with appropriations, and with the legislative branch as a whole. So what this bill would do is it would not change the process. Not change the process as it goes now. All it would require is for the district courts to have their budget and have it presented then to Section D. Section D then can give it the stamp. I believe this would help in just even subtle. It could be subtle things when you have your peers appropriating money, when you have judges appropriating money to judges. I believe that can open the door for just even subtle non-things. I believe that is a power for us here as the Appropriations Committee. And you might hear in opposition to this that this is going to require us to be more exact on our budgets. That's a lot of district court budgets. There's going to be a lot of paperwork. I don't believe we should let paperwork stand in the way of transparency. So the bottom line is, I don't think that a council of five judges should be a powerful Appropriations Committee. I believe that is up to our job, and that's all this bill does. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, are there proponents? Proponents online. Are there opponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Beth McLaughlin. That's McLaughlin, and I'm the Supreme Court Administrator. I'm in the uncomfortable position of opposing a bill from the Speaker, which is not the most pleasant place to be on a Friday morning. I think there are some significant misunderstandings about the role of the District Court Counsel and also misunderstanding about what this bill would actually do in the practicality. The District Court Counsel was established by the legislature in 2001, when the legislature assumed control of the District Court and took over the funding mechanism and all of the employees associated with the district courts. There was vastly different funding and employees across the courts, and as part of that bill, they established a district court council which was charged with establishing policies and making decisions about workload and distribution of staff. So initially, within the first 5 years of the district court council, they set some practical things around how much we would pay for guardian ad litems, what the minimum level of staff would look like per judge, and then made recommendations to the Supreme Court for the budget to come out of the Supreme Court to the legislature. They have no authority to appropriate money. They have no authority to appropriate resources within the branch. They make recommendations to the Supreme Court, and they follow the statute. So the practicality of this is where we are having the most heartburn. Right now, as those of you on Section D know, the judicial branch has a budget of about $100 million over the biennium, and that's divided into five programs. One of those programs is the district court program. The budget for the district court program is about $60 million over the biennium and contains, within that $60 million, 90% of that is employee salaries. And we have probably the most boring set of employees of any of the branches that you look at. We have judges, and those judges have a court reporter, they have a law clerk, and they have a judicial assistant. There are no large sets of staff anywhere else in the state. And within that is also our youth courts. Those are juvenile probation officers. So the smallest district court has four employees. That would be the judge, court reporter, judicial assistant, and a probation officer. That's the 14th Judicial District, which is a above Yellowstone County. The largest judicial district has about 50 employees. So that's 8 judges, their staff, and youth court staff. So what this bill is directing us to do is to move away from a single district court program and create 22 programs within the state budget. So when you would see our budget presented in Section D, we would not have a 5-program budget. You would have 27 programs, each district court, having its own budget. As I said, 90% of what we pay in the district courts is salaries for judges, staff, and youth court staff. The other 10% are what we refer to as variable costs. And that is about $5.5 million over the biennium. And we call those variable because they move all of the time. About two-thirds of those costs are jury fees and costs associated with actually convening a jury. The others are guardian ad litem costs of fees associated with child abuse and neglect cases. Those are outlined specifically in 35901. The costs that we pay, with the exception of things like postage and phones, are all outlined in 35901. And we manage it as a single fund because it moves all the time. Every year, it's different in every district court. If the district court in Broadwater County has a 3-week jury trial this year, we have to pay those expenses. So we have this managed at a top level so we can move money without... we can meet our statutory obligations without having to go through a complicated process to move money around. So what we would move from after 20 years is a 22-program system in the district courts. We've tried to think how we would do this. We would probably look at 10-year averages and then establish programs that, and this is getting into just budget picky and stuff, but I think you need to understand the actual impact of this. We would establish programs based on a 10-year average. We would come to the legislature and say, here are the 22 judicial districts. Here's what we're proposing as their budget. You would leave, and by August, we would be moving money, and we would have to be moving money with a budget change document. And some of these districts would be so small that it would not only require a budget change document and permission from the budget office, but we would be coming to LFC to ask for permission to move jury fees, to move things that are statutorily required. And the practical impact of that on my staff, the budget office staff, and your staff is pretty overwhelming. So, for instance, on a very micro level, the 10th Judicial District contains the Judith Basin County, Fergus County, and Petroleum County. Petroleum County went almost 20 years without a jury trial. And then there was a homicide in Petroleum County, and that was a 3-week jury trial. We have to pay those bills. You have statutorily told us that we have to pay those bills. That judicial district, if it were a separate program, would have not have had the budget to pay those bills because they've historically have never paid those. So we would have had to go to the budget office, move money from somewhere else, and then come to you because it would have hit the turning point for needing LFC approval before we could have paid those bills. So the practical aspect of this, both for our branch, the executive branch, and the legislative branch, is, like I said, fairly overwhelming. Now, I need to be clear, we have no qualms with transparency. We at length discuss the district court budget with Section D. We did talk a little bit about how many jury trials there are in each district, but we didn't get into great detail about how much postage or how much judicial travel we pay in each district. We have no problem doing that. If you said to me today, I want a historical average of what you've paid in travel for each judicial district, I would have that for you by Monday. So transparency and outlining where we pay bills is absolutely something that we would provide to the legislature, and welcome any sort of reporting requirement to the interim Section D committee if that makes folks feel more comfortable. This bill, though, does not change or alter what the district court council does. And just to be clear, the district court council has no appropriating authority whatsoever within the branch. It cannot change what you have told us. It cannot change the budget that's moved forward from the Supreme Court. It just allows us to move money around in a way that meets our obligations under 35901. So I would respectfully ask that you table this bill and perhaps look at doing something along a reporting requirement if that makes folks feel more comfortable with how these dollars are spent. Thank you.
Additional opponents?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amy Sassano, S-A-S-S-A-N-O. I'm the Deputy Budget Director. I think Ms. McLaughlin effectively demonstrated the impacts that this bill have. I won't say the word motives, but the desire of the sponsor to, as he expressed in his opening, is not the reason for our objection to this bill. I guess our objection is that the information that is desired can be, or changes in statute, if that's what it takes, can be accomplished in a different way than this one. This one creates a significant amount of bureaucratic unnecessity, if that's even a word, that I don't think helps to accomplish what the sponsor is trying to get to. We would be happy to work with the sponsor to find alternative solutions, but we don't think this is the right solution. And so we oppose this particular methodology. Thank you.
Additional opponents? Opponents online. Informational. Okay, questions from the committee. Representative Wendy Boyd.
Probably a question for you, Mr. Chairman. Has this particular bill gone to any policy committee?
Nope, this is its first hearing, but it does directly impact appropriations, right? That's the discussion, is whether what appropriations rules are or not.
Thank you, and the reason why I'm asking is why has this not been to a policy committee? I mean, every other bill, and usually you're always making the statement that we're only here to look at the fiscal note, and I don't even see a fiscal note on this thing.
Representative Wendy Boyd, the Section D, our section that looks at appropriations for courts, is where this information normally ends up. Section D has indicated that they have not been able to see, or the chairman of Section D has indicated that the transparency discussed is not necessarily the transparency provided. I can potentially redirect that to Representative Mercer, and so I'm not putting words in his mouth.
No, but I want to ask a question to the gal from that first opponent. I can't remember her name.
Ms. McLaughlin.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. McLaughlin, the question I have here is, the way I understand, there's supposed to be three branches of government, the legislative, the administrative, and the judicial. Do you see the possibility of this violating those three separate parts of government?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wendy Boyd, I am not a lawyer. I do not play one on TV, and I don't feel like I can answer that question, especially with Representative Mercer staring at me.
Well, if I, can I redirect that to Representative Mercer, if I may?
Mr. Chairman, and
you can answer any other questions if you're seeing a question. And
yeah, no, I think to your first question, I think this is the place to have the discussion, because the question is transparency for our appropriations process. So I think to have a direct referral here is fine. And in terms of separation of powers, I mean, it's the job of this branch to set the budget for, in this case, the judicial branch. So I think there is no problem. I mean, this, you can see that the legislature, given the code sections that are in House Bill 722, we already have a number of directives in terms of what we will pay for, what will be provided by the branch. And so I think it's a legitimate question for us to be wrestling with. That is what we would expect as part of the budgeting process.
Additional questions? Representative Beatty.
Thank you, Chairman Jones. There may be a question in here in a minute, but you know, we had a similar difficulty with the program structure for the state library, one program that oversaw a lot of diverse things. And you know, one of the objections to that, to breaking that down, was similar to the objection that's been made here. You know, you create separate programs, you end up with budget modification document, budget change documents proliferating. I will say, during the last interim, we worked out that solution and devised a reporting requirement for the state library that met our needs for transparency. And I guess I'll direct this question to the chairman of Section D, who probably will be looking for this. If I understand things correctly, you would want to have a complete differentiation of the budgets and the execution of those budgets for each of the 22 district courts. And this is to Representative Mercer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beatty, I think I understand the question. The bill, I think, stands for the proposition that when we give a lump sum to the branch to finance district courts, that doesn't provide a great deal in the way of transparency in terms of the way those dollars are then utilized within the district court system. And so I read the bill to say that we would be setting the budgets for each of the district courts, and then the district courts would be living within whatever we appropriated per judicial district. And then furthermore, I think what I've heard both from the court administrator here today and in a separate conversation, that she's got concerns about the administrative ability, there's a better way to say that, administrative ability of such a system, that if we looked at a historical average of Petroleum County, we would fund it at a particular level that might quickly be out of balance with what we appropriated if there's a 3-week jury trial there. So I understand that, and I guess what I'm trying to think through in my own head is whether there's a way to stick with the concept of the bill and to have some carve-out categories like travel or jury fees or something that we broke out separate from what we gave to a specific judicial district that would have less of a demand for budget change documents and reporting. And I'm going to ask at some point Ms. Sassano some of these questions as well. Whether we could stick with the concept and do some things that carved out categories that might create an out-of-balance situation to a greater extent than, say, would judicial salaries, which are plug numbers, which we know right now what those are going to be. So I'm trying, that's so, and then the idea of a reporting requirement, the branch does a good job of reporting. We asked the branch for reports, but we haven't focused on this degree of granularity and whether a reporting requirement on all of these factors would be a more effective approach is something that I think the committee is going to have to debate. So I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Follow up. I'll just reiterate what I said at first. We've tested this concept with an agency and got satisfactory results last time. Of course, your creation, Representative Mercer, the Interim Budget Committees, provides us a mechanism to provide that kind of oversight. And I would suggest we strongly consider this as a solution to the problem that the Speaker has brought forward in his bill here, and contemplate in a sense, codifying this by making this directive within your companion bill. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And again, I do want to state that we do some original hearings. This committee is capable of originally hearing bills that either impact the revenue side or the appropriation side. It can originally hear bills, and this bill talks. So the legislature, whether you're in the executive or the judicial, is the sole authority for appropriation, right? And so we do hear original bills at times. This one, I would say, because it discusses appropriation, transparency on appropriation, and our ability to control appropriation probably is appropriate as original hearing. And it discusses policies that are directed towards how we would achieve transparency on appropriations or changes we might want to make to that transparency or that control. And so within that scope, I saw no issue with this bill being assigned direct. With that, questions from the committee. Representative Mercer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I've got a question for Ms. Sasano.
Ms. Sasano.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Sasano, I wonder if some of your concerns can be minimized if we do what I said, which is try to have the structure of the bill intact, but to carve out certain categories that are likely to require budget change documents. It seems like that would be possible. Would your opposition be the same if we went in that direction?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mercer, the goal, I guess, of myself, I won't speak for the sponsor, is to find the right level of transparency that allows you as legislators and appropriators to see what's going on, but still allow the process to be efficient. Efficiency's been the word of the day, and this proposed solution is pretty inefficient. There, I think, a combination of a change in House Bill 2, perhaps not in the number of programs, but a limited number of line items. As you said, the fixed cost budget of the courts, I think, is really not the issue here. It's more the variable costs. The concept of fixed and variable costs for the district court program has been a concept since district court assumption. I guess what I would caution you about is perhaps looking at those variable costs as a whole and not as travel and, getting into that level of minutiae also is pretty inefficient when there are, your staff can run a report out of the accounting system at any time if anybody has any questions about that. But we're really talking about, less than 10% of the budget of this division that's really, I think, the root of all the concern, and so perhaps a focus more specifically on that would be more appropriate.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a question for Ms. McLaughlin as well.
Ms. McLaughlin.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. McLaughlin, do you have a copy of the bill?
I do.
So I'm on page 2, and I think in some ways the way that we've structured that statute is confusing. It says, the title of it is District Court Counsel, Administration of State Funding at District Courts. And I think your testimony is that sub 1 pertains to the District Court Counsel and what its role is, but sub 2 and sub 3 don't have anything to do with the District Court Counsel. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mercer, I did not write the statute. It's a 2001 statute. It's straight from state assumption. The way that we have always interpreted it, and I've been with the branch since the District Court Counsel was created and chaired by
Chief Justice Carla Gray. They are in charge of adopting the policies and procedures that govern how we spend money in the district courts. So, for instance, they approve the rate for attorney guardian ad litems. Initially, the council had a lot more, this is probably, nothing's too far in the weeds for you. He's our chair. Originally, there was a lot more, I think, stress and emphasis on how they established rates and policies, because part of what occurred in district court assumption was assumption of the public defender system. That's how the public defender system came to be attached to the state. It was attached to the courts. So there was a lot more activity at the beginning around policy setting for rates for public defenders, reimbursement strategies for witness fee or investigators for public defenders. It was a much more complicated system at the start. Right now, what they do is review policies. They review the budget proposals that come out of the district courts. They review the workload study and establish the workload study. They're in charge of performance measures. It's a much more policy-driven animal than it is an appropriation or money-driven animal. If you look at Section 3 or Section 2 and Section 3, I see those as directing my office and the branch as to what we can do. So money appropriated for the district court program can't be used for any other purpose. And then if you drop down to 35901, which is the section below in this bill, that tells us from you what we can use that money for. So I hope that answers your question. I think, like I said, I think it was a very different animal at the beginning, largely because we received all of these employees and entities from 56 counties, including public defense. And so there had to be some body that was charged with establishing a set of practices and policies and protocol to manage that. And their policies are advisory to the Supreme Court, which has ultimate authority for setting judicial branch policy. Does that answer the question?
Ms. Chairman, it does answer what I was asking, I think. I mean, I think in some ways, Mr. Chairman and Ms. McLaughlin, I think in some ways, 2 and 3 really are aimed at the second part of what the heading is. And then Section 1 is sort of, they're all conflated in this section. But I do have a follow-up, if I may, Ms. Chairman.
Follow-up.
So in your description of what the council does on the shall adopt policies, procedures, you noted review budget proposals with district courts. So I think part of what the bill is designed to do is get at that interaction. What is it that the district courts are asking for? What is it that the council is saying with respect to that? And I'm beginning to wonder whether, you know, we could formulate 3.1.16.01 differently. Is this the only, to your knowledge, and I have not looked it up, do you know if there is any other description of the role of the district court council anywhere else in the code, or is that the only place it's mentioned?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mercer, there's actually a section of code that explains who's on the council, and I think it provides a little bit more detail about their duties as well. So the council is the 5 voting members, as Speaker Regeer said, and then there are also some non-voting members that represent employee groups, and then the counties. We have 1 county commissioner. So there's that section of code, and I think it has some details about additional responsibilities.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll look that up, but I thank you for that additional information on that.
Additional questions? Gillette, Representative Gillette, are you? Oh, no, you're just asked. I thought you were reaching for your mic. Sorry. Okay, seeing none, if the sponsor would like to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So a few things, Representative Mercer. To your question is on more MCA here is 3-1-1602, which is district court counsel appointment, composition, duties, and staggered terms. And then if you go to 3, it says a district court counsel should develop and adopt policies, procedures subject to review by the Supreme Court to administer the state funding of district courts. So basically, I mean, we've got 6 subcommittees here and another, the 7th subcommittee appropriations of 5 judges that are administering the budgets of all our district courts. And I believe that is the job of us here. As you've heard, a lot of paperwork. This is going to be paperwork. This is going to be budget change documents. There's a lot of ways to save. I mean, we could just adopt the governor's budget on day one, save a lot of paperwork and printing. So if that's what we're scared of and we want to abdicate our power because of secretarial stuff, that's, I guess, our choice. For me, it is not so much about transparency. I don't doubt that the department would provide any numbers that we wanted. This is about influence. And should 5 judges have that kind of influence, or is that something for Section D and appropriations and us as the legislative branch? It's about influence. So thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. That closes the hearing. We're going to give our clerk a little bit of time to get spun up for amendments. Oh, well, I guess we don't have to give her a little bit of time. But I do have to wait till the vice chair gets back, though. Where did he go? Let's take, please don't wander off, but let's stand at ease for 5 minutes while we find the vice chair.
Okay, let's work our way back to our seats. As soon as the clerk's back, we are going to spin this baby up.
Well, you could take multiple districts or something. That's interesting to me, too. We can change that up if you wanted to file down.
Waiting briefly for our clerk here.
I did turn your speaker on, so I could tell him to come back to their seat.
She may be right down the road if she is.
You ready?
Okay, we'll go ahead and call the committee back to order. Please take your seats. Vice Chair Keenan.
Mr. Chairman, I move due pass on House Bill 55.
It's been moved due pass on House Bill 55, and, oh, wait, Mr. Fitzpatrick is not here.
Well, in that case, I'll move an amendment that was drafted in my name.
How about we just, let's...
call the question.
Yeah, let's change the order here. So if you will.
I will withdraw my motion on House Bill 55.
And let's, if you don't mind, sir, let's go to 569.
I'll make a motion to do pass on House Bill 569.
So move do pass on House Bill 569. Representative Moore, do you have an amendment?
I do. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I move to adopt an amendment, HB 0569.001.001.
On your amendment, sir.
Yes. There are, frankly, as I mentioned the other day when we heard the bill, a host of modifications and cleanup as we tried to pull in 119, and so that's why you see on the board 119. So I wanted to review with you first where those items are so that we're assured that House Bill 119 is embedded in here. And there were a couple of modifications. So on the first page of the amendment, there is on beginning on line 18, is a new section where you see the Highway Patrol, that there would be a statutory appropriation of $27.6 million. Also, the next section is the Sheriff's with $26.8 million. And the third section is changed from House Bill 119. So I wanted to spend just a moment on that. That would change to $41.2 million. And that would be on the game warden, peace officer, statutory appropriation. So all three of these now with that modification would be adjusted downward from that $107 million number to $95.6 million. So roughly $11 million less. The adjustment on the game warden, peace officer had to do with another item that was embedded in 119, but when the numbers were... when the numbers were pulled from the actuary, they did not take into account that the peace officer employer contribution was going to increase from 9% to 10.56%. So although that was embedded in 119, the number when calculating the statutory appropriation was incorrect.
And so that was just a, I'll say, a cleanup to move that downward. So there's a savings there of roughly $11 million. And just a reminder of House Bill 569, that these three appropriations take three of the plans that had an amortization of something greater than 30 years and so needed to be addressed, and bottom down not just to 30 years, but buys it down to 25 years. And so that's what these appropriations are doing in total. There are a couple of cleanup items. I don't have the pages here, just a second. 19-6. Page 10. Well, it says page 10. I guess it would be page 10 of an amendment. Section 9. The amount for what was in here on 19-4 needed to be corrected. Again, it was just an error in how it pulled over when we drafted it, so it went back to its original form of 38.33%. So we're just correcting it back the way it should have been. And then on 19-7-404, it went back to 13.15, and that seems a little bit confusing. I've been reassured by the folks that administer the retirement plan that is the correct number, and that is the current employer contribution, and that's what we were trying to get. And so that there is no increase in employer contributions as a result of 569 nor this amendment. And then, Mr. Chair, a couple of additional items that are contained in this. It's in the revised language on the front of the page, and so the body of the work is embedded here, is providing an adjustment to the amortization, let me just find the sections. It starts on page 12 of the amendment, that the eligibility for service retirement of only new employees doesn't impact any current employees whatsoever. For both the Highway Patrol and the Sheriff Plan, pension plan, would require not just 20 years of service, but also having attained age 50. And that then would align those two plans with the same general requirement as the game warden and peace officer. So that's why that one was not done, because they already had that provision as a part of their plan, and that would only apply to new employees starting July 1st. Mr. Chair, I would stand for questions.
Are there questions or discussion on the amendment? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for the sponsor of the amendment. You did a nice job of explaining all the technical corrections, but when we get to page 12, that's no longer a technical correction. That's a substantive policy change, I believe. And so my question there is, Representative Moore, describe to us your interactions with the stakeholders in this one as you created this amendment.
Mr. Chair, I did not engage with the stakeholders in that there are no new employees that I could engage with, and so there was no change to any existing employee in this regard. I have engaged with folks that are involved in just the pension from some of the folks in the retirement board as to what are the benefits and how are they different among the various plans. Representative, Mr. Chair.
Additional discussion, questions?
I'd like to just finish one thing. I think he adequately answered that question, but it does give me a pause. I think the good representative has worked very hard on this stuff and understands it very well. And certainly in his conversations with Reason Foundation has understood that these kinds of more substantive changes get done by getting all the stakeholders in the room and everybody talking about it. And so it gives me great pause. That didn't happen. I would say I agree. There are no new employees. How can you talk to the new employees? But there are people trying to hire these new employees, and those are the stakeholders. So because of that, rest of the amendment's fine, but this part of the amendment will make me vote against it. And if this goes on the bill, I'll vote against the bill, despite my appreciation and yes vote if this was not on the bill. Thank you.
Okay, additional discussion? Okay, close on your amendment, sir.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative, and thanks for your encouragement, perhaps, as we go down this path of trying to address our pension unfunded liabilities. I would say, you know, in the haste of things, because a lot of this is happening almost real time, I did engage with one of our colleagues that was a recent retiree of one of these plans to say, is this an... You know, is this like leaning way out over the skis and very unreasonable? And he assured me that it was not, and he thought, if anything, it was prudent, having been a recent retiree of one of these plans that would be impacted with a new employee. And in his judgment, he did not think that it would impact in a negative way recruitment or and retention in any way. So that gave me a lot more confidence that I wasn't too far out over those skis in this regard. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, roll call vote on the amendment, please.
Vice Chair Keenan.
Yes.
Representative Beattie.
Yes.
Representative Binkley.
Yes.
Vice Chair Cafaro.
No.
Representative Kirk-Carpenter.
No.
Representative Falk.
Yes.
Representative Fitzpatrick.
Yes.
Representative Gillette.
Yes.
Representative Hamilton.
No.
Representative Hastings.
Yes.
Representative Hillegard.
Yes.
Representative Hopkins.
Yes.
Representative Keough.
No.
Representative Mercer.
Yes.
Representative Moore.
Yes.
Representative Knave.
Yes.
Representative Stuart Paraguay.
No.
Representative Reed.
That's you, sir.
Representative Reed votes yes by proxy.
Representative Regeer.
Yes.
Representative Schillinger.
Yes.
Representative Tuss.
No.
Representative Wendy Boy.
No.
Chair Jones.
Yes. Amendment passes.
Mr. Chairman, I move to pass on House Bill 569 as once amended.
It's been moved to pass as once amended. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move amendment 569.001.002 do pass.
Representative, on your amendment.
Lots of pages here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lots of pages here for what turns out to be a really minor thing, but it's the same change that I had suggested on 226 yesterday, which is, and you can see it for the first time on page 8. The page is labeled 8. It's the third page in. The closed amortization period for all contemporaneous, whatever the right word is there, liabilities, instead of being 10 years, make it 15 years. We've made, with the contribution of a large amount of money there, we have taken it down to a 25-year amortization, should this go through. And so certainly if we slowed down the closed amortization, a little bit lower price tag on it, and we'd still get to where we're going. So I would urge you to vote for this amendment.
Representative Moore.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and good representative. Like you, I don't like surprises and things to be jerked around back and forth. I would just encourage you to resist the amendment and under this premise. Number one, the actuary uses a smoothing method of 5 years so that we don't have this knee-jerk from year to year of investment returns being unusually high or unusually low. Also, then that five-year smoothing is baked into 10 years. So there's that level of amortizing it even further, so it's just not an immediate adjustment. And then as well as now that we have some plans that are at 25 years and marching away, that would also have less impact as those continue to get paid down. So I would encourage you to resist the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, additional discussion on the amendment. Would the sponsor like to close on his amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good memory. I don't have a whole lot more to say on it. You know that the Blue Ribbon Society of Actuaries recommends a amortization period of 15 to 20 years. And once again, the fact that this was at 10, they go as high as 20. 15 seemed like a good compromise there. And so I would urge you to vote yes.
Okay, roll call vote, please.
Just a second. I pushed the wrong button. Vice Chair Keenan.
No.
Representative Beattie.
No.
Representative Binkley.
No.
Vice Chair Cafaro.
Yes.
Representative Kirk Harbinder.
Yes.
Representative Falk.
No.
Representative Fitzpatrick.
No.
Representative Gillette.
Yes.
Representative Hamilton.
Yes.
Representative Hastings.
No.
Representative Hillegard.
No.
Representative Hopkins.
No.
Representative Keough.
Yes.
Representative Mercer.
No.
Representative Moore.
No.
Representative Knave.
No.
Representative Stuart Paraguay.
Yes.
Representative Reed.
Representative Reed.
No by proxy.
Representative Regeer.
No.
Representative Schillinger.
No.
Representative Tess.
Yes.
Representative Windy Boy.
Yes.
Chair Jones.
No. Amendment fails. Back on the bill as once amended. Discussion. Seeing Representative Beattie.
Yes, Chairman Jones, I want to be clear. This particular bill as amendment does have a fairly significant one-time only appropriation, correct?
It does, sir.
And do you happen to know how large that OTO is?
Representative Moore could touch that. I believe it's about $95 million now.
Yeah, Chair Representative, it is now $95.6 million in the bill. The HB 119 that we will take a peek at, assuming this passes, was at $107 million, and it was an adjustment of $11 million on the game wardens because we increased the employer contribution, which is all paid by the state general fund anyway.
Thank you, Chairman Jones. Just comment. Sounds like money well spent to me.
Okay. Roll call vote. And just a correction on that. So that game wardens is actually paid by the state special of the. So it's not a general fund, but just
thank
so
you for
I
the,
got that on the record.
Correction.
So roll call vote.
Vice Chair Keenan.
Yes.
Representative Beattie.
Yes.
Representative Binkley.
Yes.
Vice Chair Cafaro.
Are we on the bill now?
Yes.
No.
Representative Kirk Harbinder.
No.
Representative Falk.
Yes.
Representative Fitzpatrick.
Yes.
Representative Gillette.
Yes.
Representative Hamilton.
Reluctantly, no.
Representative Hastings.
Yes.
Representative Hillegard.
Yes.
Representative Hopkins.
Yes.
Representative Keough.
No.
Representative Mercer.
Yes.
Representative Moore.
Yes.
Representative Knave.
Yes.
Representative Stuart Paraguay.
No.
Representative Reed.
I didn't know what to do with the rest of it, so there. No.
Representative Reed votes yes by proxy.
Representative Regeer.
Yeah.
Representative Schillinger.
Yes.
Representative Tuss.
No.
Representative Windy Boy.
No.
Chair Jones.
Yes. Bill passes.
16-7.
I move to pass on House Bill 119.
So it's been moved to pass on 119, which was contained in the other bill. Do you want to briefly address that, Representative Moore?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representatives. As was mentioned a couple of days ago, I have visited with the sponsor, and the sponsor has visited with some of the members of the SAVA Interim Committee, where we have taken their recommendations and integrated those into 569, and they are supportive of this measure and how things are moving forward and the provisions that are in 569. And so I would make a substitute motion that we table House Bill 119.
It's a non-debatable motion. Do we want to do this with a voice vote, or do we want to call a proxy? Any objection to a voice? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Let the record know it went a table unanimous by those that are present.
Mr. Chairman, I move due pass on House Bill 55.
I move due pass on House Bill 55, Representative Fitzpatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I move Amendment HB 0055.003.004.
Representative, on your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, this is a very substantive rewrite of House Bill 55. As you recall, when Representative Logie presented the bill to us, the way the bill was crafted was that the tax on electric vehicles was to be levied at the charging station, and that there was a mechanism in place at the charging station, or was needed to have a mechanism in place at the charging station, where the people using the chargers could get a receipt, and those that were Montana residents would then apply for a refund at the end of the year from the Department of Transportation. Because of the nature of some of the charging stations that have been installed, we have charging stations that don't have meters and the capacity to measure the sale of electricity to a car owner. And so there was a series, essentially, of delayed effective dates in the bill that basically pushed the tax collection period out to about 2025 at the earliest and then to 2028. Now, when you take a look at tax legislation, there's kind of a standard saying that there are three elements to a good tax. One is that it raises a lot of revenue. Second, that it's easy to administer. And third, it's paid by the other guy. And as a practical matter, if you look at taxes in Montana, the coal severance tax is about a perfect tax because it does raise a tremendous amount of revenue. There are about four or five taxpayers. The ease of administration is phenomenal. And it's not paid by the people in Montana for the most part, except for those who are Northwestern customers where the coal severance tax is buried in your electric bill. But a large part of that tax is exported out of state with the coal that goes to other states. Now, what I've done with this bill is try to simplify it. And the simplification comes in about three different ways. The first one is that instead of trying to collect the tax at the meter, that's an administrative problem because there are potentially hundreds, if not thousands, of charging station owners, all of which would be required to basically pay their taxes on a monthly or quarterly basis. Second thing, the notion here of giving back a refund to people in Montana that use that is frankly an administrative burden and an expense that really probably doesn't compute. Most people that have electric cars will charge them at home. They may take the occasional trip from one city to another and need to use a charging station, and they'll pay some tax when they do that. But that's really not much different than what we have right now with the bed tax. Most of us pay nothing for bed tax because we sleep at home, and when we come to Helena, we rent an apartment or something of that type, and we only pay bed tax when we take a trip to another city in Montana, maybe spend a day or two visiting relatives or whatever, and then we pay the bed tax. But we don't go through a process of then requesting a refund. So what I'm trying to do with this bill or these amendments is essentially simplify that administrative burden, provide a mechanism to start collecting the tax earlier, and then to provide an opportunity in here so that the smaller charging stations will be essentially exempt from the tax and that it will not be placed on residential properties. So there's a number of amendments. Let me take them through you page by page. We start off on page one on lines 15 and 16, and we put in new language that makes it clear that a charging station is not installed at a residence and it has a rated capacity greater, and it must have a rated capacity greater than 25 kilowatts. Okay, that basically gets rid of the home charging stations, and it will get rid of some of the public charging stations, which are fairly small in size. Then we used the word public to make it clear down in section two that we're talking about public charging stations, not those in residence. And then on line 22, the word for profit before business has been struck. This has basically been done to prevent people from gaming the system, because the minute you put that word for profit in there, I will guarantee you that charging station owners will create a nonprofit corporation, and hence the tax will not be collected. If we move on to page two, we start getting into the some more substantive stuff. On page two, line three, the definition of a public utility has the meaning defined in 69.3.101. That covers basically the investor-owned utilities, Northwestern Energy and Montana Dakota Utilities. It also incorporates the co-ops. I was offered an amendment from the co-ops that wanted it defined in 69.8.103, and that, of course, would then limit this law specifically to Northwestern Energy. Montana has interesting energy policy. We have 29 electric service providers in the state of Montana, but for the most part, whenever we talk about statewide energy policy, it really only applies to Northwestern Energy. I'm resisting that effort in this case because I think the only way this tax works is if it's applicable to all of the parties supplying electricity, and it's applicable in all 56 counties. Now, we start on section two. I changed the word 25 to 23. It's effective 2023, there's a tax of 3 cents per kilowatt in addition to the public utilities approved rate. Now, that language approved rate is essentially a way of avoiding this thing ending up in front of the Public Service Commission for an 18-month cost of service study and rate-setting endeavor. Both the co-ops and the investor-owned utilities currently have approved rates for their various classes of customers. Some have more classes, some have fewer, but they will all have a commercial rate. And since this will be a commercial rate that's been approved, essentially, once the bill is adopted, they will be able to charge the charging station owner the utility's approved rate plus the tax. So there's no need basically to go to the Public Service Commission until such time as they bring in a rate case at some point in the future. Now we move on to part on page three. Oh, I want to back up for a second here on page two. When we start the tax in 2023, it will basically be on those installations that are installed after July 1. So in other words, people putting in new chargers will be expected to pay the tax right out of the chute. And then we make provision in section two for those that have essentially older systems. They've got a couple of years basically to implement the tax on the older systems and gives them a chance to put in the meters. Now, I skipped over it because I'm not used to the way of amending these bills. There's a new Section 3 called Installation of Electric Meters. And what we're saying here is that all new public charging stations must have a meter installed or approved by the public utility exclusively dedicated to the charging station, which measures all of the electricity delivered to the public charging station. Then in the next session, they've got more time to have those meters installed. And then finally, by 2028, any of the legacy systems that are still in effect must have a way of installing software or hardware that allow them to register the amount of electricity being delivered to the motor vehicle. Now, it's the public charging station's responsibility to comply with this section. It is not the duty of the public utility to enforce compliance. Now, the reason I'm requesting that we put the separate the meter out there is that becomes an easy way then to collect the tax. Right now, you have no ability to really collect the tax at the meter because the charging station is getting a feed of electricity off a structure, and that meter that's on there is measuring the electricity both to the structure as well as to the charging station. By having them required to put up a meter, then we can tax right at the point where the electricity is being delivered to the charging station. Now, you do not have to have a meter per charging station. A 200-amp service will service 5 to 6 charging stations, the average size of which is 32 amp. We do have the higher amperage services used by Tesla. They would probably take a 400-amp service. Those are 80 amp services. So you put in a 400-amp services, you're going to get 4 or 5 charging stations. I personally have never seen a charging station with more than 4 chargers. The meter installation is at the cost of the charging station owner. That's not an onerous burden. I did a meter here last year on a new house I built. It was $1,500. In the Northwestern system, all of the meters are installed by contract electricians. Once they get the stamp from inspector, then the utility comes out, reviews whether or not the thing is appropriately, and then they start delivering service. I left the words in there, installed or improved by. I don't know what the co-ops do in the rural areas. Maybe the co-ops install their own meters for customers. So there's leeway there for the installation of these facilities. Now we go on to page 3. Down on line 21, it says that public utilities shall collect the tax of 3 cents in its monthly invoice to the charging station owner and remit the proceeds as calculated to the Department of Transportation within 30 days following the preceding calendar quarter. So they have to basically make 4 filings a year. The public utility will remit 2.75 cents for each kilowatt, and the utility can keep 0.25 cents per kilowatt to cover their costs associated with collecting the tax. Now, in the short term, that's no money. It's also, there's not going to be that much tax revenue raised because this is essentially a new industry coming to Montana. But 10 years from now, it's going to generate a lot of tax, and it's going to generate a fair amount of revenue to the utility who's collecting the tax money. I put in a provision here to give the utilities maximum flexibility in terms of how they set up their billing systems. If they wish to create a new class of customers for billing, it's done at their discretion, and it consists solely of those in the charging thing. Based on my conversations with both the co-ops and Northwestern, I believe that they will probably put these folks into their existing small commercial customer class and go forward from there. The billing must approve, the billing for from the charging stations must include the tax as well as the utilities approved rate or tariff. And that's just to repeat more or less what we said. Taxes collected in accordance with exception are not subject to review or approval by the Public Service Commission. We've mandated a tax. We're just making it clear that the Public Service Commission cannot come back to one of the regulated utilities and say, well, we've decided that you should only get rate recovery for 2.5. And frankly, they do play that game with them when it comes to property taxes. So the utilities have simply asked for additional piece of protection here. I eliminated sections 5 about extensive rulemaking, and I got rid of the public charging station inspection. This is not gasoline, which someone who's a corrupt owner of a station can, in fact, game the way pumps deliver gasoline with an electric meter. The only way you're going to cheat on this thing is if you try to run a cable between the meter and the charging station and run the electricity back in the building. There's not very many owners that are that stupid, but there might be a few, but it's not going to be a big issue. You do occasionally have a problem with an electric meter, but that's very, very rare. I mean, when I was working for Northwestern, we might see bad meter complaints at the Public Service Commission, maybe a half a dozen in a month for 300,000 electric customers. It's frankly not a big issue. And then we get on the last page. We have changed the codification instruction so that this is part of Title 69, Chapter 3, which is the section of law that deals with public utilities rather than the tax title. And then it becomes effective on passage and approval. And I would encourage your support for this amendment. I think it's a efficient way of collecting future tax revenues from electric vehicles. It does have it does place the administrative burden on the electric utilities. The co-ops do not like that responsibility. Northwestern has been fine with it, and they will be the ones sharing the major load. Because of the nature of their service territory, these charging stations will be largely located in Northwestern's service territory. And that service territory on the High Line runs from Glasgow to Cutbank. It runs from Shelby down I-15 to Lima. And it runs from Forsyth all along I-90 to St. Regis. And these charging stations are going to be located in communities for the most part. They're not going to be located out in rural areas, which are predominantly served by the co-ops. If you draw a line between, say, Browning to Great Falls and then on down to Billings, that area north and east of that line will be very, very slow to adopt electric vehicles. It'll be very slow to see charging stations installed there, except along the major highways. And that's simply because the distances in eastern Montana, the climate they have, is not terribly suitable to electric vehicles as they are currently designed. Now, perhaps 10 years from now, when batteries are more efficient and don't draw down in the wintertime, you'll see more of that. But those areas are probably not going to see much in the way of electric vehicles for a long time. The co-ops that are most likely to be affected by this piece of legislation is Flathead Electric. Flathead Electric, by the way, is not an itty-bitty little co-op. It is the second largest electricity supplier in Montana. It probably has now somewhere between 70 and 80,000 customers. It's well over double the size of MDU. Missoula Electric, because it has areas like, for example, out along Reserve Street, which is outside the Northwestern Service Territory, but developed by the co-ops, they will see some activity. You may see some activity in the co-op areas down in Ravalli County, but again, most of Ravalli County along the highway is Northwestern Service Territory. And then finally, you will see some COAC activity in Yellowstone County, where Yellowstone Valley has some services, generally out in the area west of Billings toward Laurel, and then again along the highway to the east. But this is not going to be a major burden on most of the cooperatives in the state of Montana. Thank you.
Representative Wendy Boyd.
Mr. Chairman, question for the sponsor of the amendment. Mr. Chairman and Representative Fitzpatrick, thinking about what you just said as far as the routes that you mentioned, and what would happen, like, say you said that this goes from Broadus to St. Regis. What about the areas from Billings to Glendive? Is there going to be anything on that route?
Mr. Chairman, yes, Representative Windy Boy, electricity east of Forsyth along Interstate 94 is MDU territory. And MDU also has the area up north of Sydney. It has Sydney. It also has basically Highway 2, which would include Wolf Point, Poplar, Culbertson, those places, all the way west to Glasgow.
Okay. Additional questions? Representative Keenan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I have an amendment, and I'm certainly not going to try and match wits with the sponsor of this amendment on utilities. I'll make that clear right off the bat. This bill went through the Transportation Committee, and I think we heard about the title change. This is, as the sponsor said, a substantive rewrite of the bill. At this stage in the process, I'm not thinking that this needs to go to a different committee, given that it will be in Title 69 rather than Title 15, but we're going to have to trust, I think, that the Senate looks at this carefully. I think the big point here is that, you know, this is a fairly major tax policy shift with having utilities collect and pay the tax as opposed to having it at the retail level. So with that, I you know, I'm not going to make any substitute motions or anything like that, but I think that we can look forward to a pretty in-depth discussion further in the process. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Additional discussion, Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm somewhat out of order, but since the new sponsor of the new bill had his opening, I just wanted to come in as a proponent and say that this is a good switch and a good change, but I wanted to make sure that as we move forward, considering how substantive it is, that we're following over to the Senate to give that explanation to them as well, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Additional discussion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hopkins, yes, I have discussed this issue with Representative Logie, and I will be the person presenting this bill on the floor as well as in front of the Senate committee.
Okay, and seeing none, I'll just have a comment as well. I also support this. I participated with NCSL in a significant discussion of how we pay for our bridges and our roads and our streets, and how do we ensure that electric vehicles don't pay more than their share. There can be punitive actions out there, but nor do they pay less, that they just participate in the provision. And so as a result, I felt that it was important that we get this right. I did not support the original bill's concept, other than bring it to a probes where there was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of little collectors out there. And I guess I do have one more question to make sure that the sponsor gets on record here. I also didn't support the concept that everybody needed an extra meter in their garage, which this doesn't offer, but I'll have him speak to that before we call the vote. I believe this is literally in Oklahoma and in other places, Tesla paid a fortune to try and not have electric vehicles touched. I don't want them punished. I just want folks out of state to participate as well. I will offer up for consideration after this an amendment that said if this goes in place, that it reduces the charge on the folks in the garage by the registration by 30%, based upon some statistics that show you drive close to your home about 70% of the time, and away from it 30%, so that our own owners of electric vehicles aren't punished. And again, we'll support the bill either way, but we'll offer that forth. I see I generated some questions, but Representative Fitzpatrick, will this impact a charger in the garage? And then I will go to you, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, this will not. This bill will not affect the folks in the garage. We've made it clear that it's public charging stations, and so whatever you have in your garage will be fine. We also have the kilowatt limit in there, and very few folks with the garage system are likely to be above 25 kilowatts.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be supporting the amendment. The only reservation I had on it is it sort of did change the original intent by Representative Logie to get some money back to Montanans who owned electric vehicles, but you have answered that question by suggesting you would run your amendment, which I will talk about at that time. Thank you.
Representative Wendy Boyd.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to support this as well. When this first came before the floor, it was kind of confusing, but after seeing this amendment, it kind of broke it down to where it made more sense, and then realizing that the MDU is going to be in play here, as well as Northwest and everybody else that's going to be in here. The concept about rate change has kind of gone way out there, like for these gas stations, just using that as an example, and the local gas station has that ability to do that. And I think that once we get this set rate on this stuff here, I think it makes sense, and that that's it, Mr. Chairman. But I'm a yes.
Okay, do we want to voice vote this, roll call vote it? And again, Representative Fitzpatrick, would you like to close? And I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to close. I never thought of it, and I thank Representative Wendy Boy for bringing it up. Because one of the things that you see with gasoline and motor fuels is that the price is quite variable at the pump. This particular bill, the way this thing is set up now, you're going to see tremendous stability at the charging station. The tax is now codified, and that's not to say that the tax can't change in the future, but electricity rates do not change very rapidly. For the investor-owned utilities, they try to push those rate cases off for as long as possible, and so you're generally looking at several years between rate cases. The co-ops have much more flexibility in that regard because they set their own rates, but they kind of follow that practice just as a matter of business prudence, and they're reluctant to change rates. So what you're likely to see here for people using charging stations is a very, very stable rate over time compared to what we experience at the gas pump. Secondly, I just want to talk a little bit again about this notion of tax collector responsibility. I understand why the co-ops would be reluctant to want to become the tax collector. And I mean, I've heard talk about, well, this could be the camel's nose under the tent and we're going to be charging, we're responsible for collecting other taxes. I frankly think that's a spurious argument because we have the gasoline distributors right now collecting the fuel tax. There's never been a piece of legislation in here asking them to do anything else, and I don't think it's likely that we're going to be coming in behind and saying to co-ops, well, it's now it's your turn to start collecting property tax. It's not going to happen. But the fact of the matter is that everybody in this room sitting at this table has either directly acted as a tax collector or works for someone who is. Every time you put together your payroll in your business, you subtract money out of your employees' checks for state income tax, for federal income tax, and for Social Security tax, and you remit that to the government on whatever basis you're required to. I used to do it on a quarterly basis. If you're not personally writing that check, your employer is. Basically, collecting taxes, while it might be distasteful to all of us, it's basically a duty that we have as part of a citizens in this country, and I don't believe that this is establishing much of a burden on the co-ops. Thank you, and I encourage your adoption of this amendment.
Okay. Do we need a roll call vote this? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Is there opposition?
Aye.
So Representative McGeer is a no, passed unanimously. Well, now you got, and Keenan's a no. So there are two no's. Is everybody here then? Because now I have to call the proxy. So, all right, I don't have to call the proxy. Every time I do that, I have to call the proxy instead of cheat the system. But anyway, so it's amendment passes 21-2. Okay, and with that, if you would.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 55 as once amended, and
would you
move to amend House Bill 55 with Amendment 55.003.003. Representative Jones.
Thank you. This is my amendment. It does what I'd shared previously, and effectively, and I'll support the bill either way, but I wanted to ensure that the folks at home, once the meters become fully online, which will be 2028, and there's electric meters out there, so that folks that have the hybrid or electric vehicle in their garage is now still not is paying a registration fee that's currently passed, right? They've already paid a registration fee, extra registration for an electric vehicle. We needed to come up with an estimate of what percentage of time, and it will not be perfect, just be clear. We needed to come up with an estimate of what percentage of time and that they would be driving within a 50-mile or so radius of their home and what percentage of time they might indeed be going down the road. And I have asked for these numbers, to be brutally honest, to be updated by like AAA and folks, but currently it's the numbers, for at least from the past, were 70-30. 70% of the time you drive relatively close to your home, 30% of the time you travel. This simply suggests that 30% of the time then, so we would reduce the charger rate in the garages at home, the registration fee, by 30% so that they weren't being double tax, right? They weren't paying the tax and then going out and paying the tax. There is some discussion of whether it's necessary because obviously when you stay away from home now, you do pay the bed tax. So there's a question whether we need to do this or not. I'll leave that to the committee. The other question I've had is now that this 70-30 is in the bill, I have been trying to get updated statistics. I believe Representative Logie requested them to see if the 70-30 is still accurate.
Where that came from is when I first arrived here all those long time ago, I actually sat on business and labor for a while. And during that time, there was a huge discussion on seat belts and that. And so insurance companies came in and said, you need to wear them all the time because 70% of the accidents occur within 50 miles of home. So I said, really, how often do you drive within 50 miles of home? And they came back later and said, well, 75% of the time. And so based upon those statistics, that at least what they're measuring is that's where people generally operate. So that's the purpose of this amendment. Questions on the amendment? Representative Kirk Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your explanation just now, you mentioned hybrid vehicles. Would this go for hybrid vehicles, or is this purely vehicles that plug into the wall?
Representative Kirk Carpenter, if you plug in, some hybrids plug in, some do not. Right? And so I guess in that case, the hybrids currently aren't charged the electrical vehicle tax at this point on their registration. So you are correct. It would go with just the solid electric vehicles. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I applaud you for proposing this amendment. I will be supporting it. However, I'd like to chide you slightly for making an amendment that's way too simple for you. And though I won't throw another amendment in, I would propose that perhaps we talk to somebody on the Senate, because the delay of this until 2028 ignores the fact that there may be on new charge stations 3 years worth of consumption that's going on that is not reducing electric vehicle registration fees. So it seems to me there might be some sense in having a layered approach, which would be much more in line with how you like to do things anyway.
Representative Hamilton, I thought about that, but I figured if I did a series of steps of taking it off, I would once again be chided for making everything too complicated. So I just tried to be simple this time. Additional discussion, Representative Fitzpatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be supporting your amendment, but in all honesty, I believe that if you're going to offer this amendment, you should be wearing a red suit with white fur, because I think you're playing Santa Claus. I doubt seriously that people using electric vehicles are going to be using charging stations 30% of the time. But the fact of the matter is we don't know. So I'm comfortable with the number for now, but we might want to adjust it later on to kind of more carefully match what's actually going out there on the road. Thank you.
So thank you. And while I don't have the beard for Santa Claus, I do have the belly, so I'm halfway there. So additional discussion on the amendment. Question's been called. Do we want to voice vote this amendment, or do we want to? All those in favor of the amendment indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Is there opposition?
Aye.
Okay, wait. So there's two. Hold your hands up long enough so we can get to two. So Representative Cafaro and Representative Helgard are noes. And Regeer is by proxy no, so there's three noes. That means it passes 20-3.
Mr. Chairman, I move to pass on House Bill 55 as twice amended.
Okay, it's due pass on House Bill 55 as twice amended. Discussion on the bill as twice amended. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be supporting the bill, but I would like to have a little bit of payback from yesterday's comment on my rant, and so I would like to award Representative Fitzpatrick as the longest opening for an amendment I've ever heard.
Yes.
All in favor?
Okay, additional discussion. Do I need to roll call vote this? Raise your hand if you're opposed to it. Okay. All those in favor of House Bill 55, correct, as twice amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Is there opposition? Seeing none, passed unanimous by those that are present. And I think Representative Regeer is the only one not present.
Pass on House Bill 276.
It's been moved to do pass on House Bill 276. I believe I have an amendment.
You do.
Do you have my amendment, 7-6?
I'll have to see what the number
just a second. We've got to locate the amendment. Effectively, what the amendment does is it cuts the amount in the bill in half. I will support the bill either way, but there was some discussion there that folks would like to, as this might represent something that may become ongoing that... you found the amendment. Go ahead and move the amendment, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I move to amend House Bill 276 with Amendment 002.001.
Okay. As I was saying, this simply cuts the amounts in half. Either way, I will vote for the bill. However, I had proposed half as it might be more palatable with that. Representative Mercer, I see you reaching for your mic.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I do have... a little bit of a different take on, I want to make sure that the record reflects this. I think the hearing record was clear that these folks were saying this is a one-time only deal, we are not coming back, and I'm going to vote no, regardless of, I'll vote for the amendment, I'm going to vote no for the concept, because I don't think we need to do it. But having said that, I really want the record to reflect that when they come back in 2 years, which I fully expect, that I want to be able to roll the tape back and say, nope, you said that you weren't coming back, and this is a one-time only deal. So I'll vote for the amendment because I think that it's good to reduce the expenditure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Fortunately, we are running tapes, so it is recorded. Representative Beatty.
Thank you, Chairman Jones. And for the record, I agree with my colleague from Billings, although I'm not so sure that we're going to see people coming back. And for my part, I'm going to oppose the amendment.
Okay. Representative Whitney Boyd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Like my colleague across the table here, I'm going to oppose the amendment. This is something that's going to help the average Montanan who don't need a handout but a hand up once in a while. We all need that. And so for that, I'm going to oppose the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Additional discussion? Let's roll call vote the amendment.
Vice Chair Keenan.
Yes.
Representative Beatty.
No.
Representative Binkley.
No.
Representative Vice Chair Caffaro.
No.
Representative Kirk Carpenter.
No by proxy.
Representative Falk.
Yes.
Representative Fitzpatrick.
No.
Representative Gillette.
Yes.
Representative Hamilton.
No.
Representative Hastings.
Yes.
Representative Hellegaard.
Yes.
Representative Hopkins.
No.
Representative Keough.
No.
Representative Mercer.
Yes.
Representative Moore.
Yes.
Representative Nave.
Yes.
Representative Stuart Paragoy.
No.
Representative Reed.
No.
Representative Regeer.
Votes yes by proxy.
Representative Schillinger.
Yes.
Representative Tuss.
No.
Representative Wendy Boy.
Nope.
Chair Jones.
Yes. Amendment fails, correct? Amendment fails. We're back on the bill as 12 to 11.
Mr. Chairman, I move to pass. Well, I think we're...
So we're on the bill as not amended. Discussion on the bill is not amended. Representative Caffaro.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'll be voting yes because it matches up two important populations of our state, farmers and people who are hungry through the food banks. It's a win-win. It's a good investment. Thank you.
Roll call vote, please. Representative Mercer, I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were ready to speak.
Hey, one of the reasons why I'm going to oppose the bill, as I've shared in the past, is I think there's some terms in here that are undefined. Is no cross-section anywhere else in the code. When I tried to look at, you see on line 25, section 2, and as I had the discussion with Mr. Jensen from the Department of Agriculture when we had the bill hearing, we used the term low-income consumers on page 25. There's no definition of what that means in terms of who's going to be eligible and how there's going to be any sort of compliance with that term, given the way this is going to be administered. And then I know somewhere in here the term underserved communities is also used. There's no discussion of what constitutes an underserved community. And when we talked about that in the context of the hearing, what I remember hearing was not even that we were looking for, based upon county economic data, there was no reference there whatsoever. All we essentially heard was that there could be an underserved community even within a community where on any indicia, you would not be able to say that that community was underserved. So there's a degree of vagueness here that will make it very difficult to have any sort of compliance. There's no meaningful way for it to have compliance. And I don't think that's the way to run a railroad. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wendy Boyd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to support this, just like my vice chair across the way had explained it eloquently. And I think that, this $1 million may seem like a lot, but it's not really a lot compared to the over half a billion dollars that proposal that's going to be given to people who don't need it. So I think that this is going to be something that's going to be useful, and this is reaching out to the farmers and saying, hey, farmers, I'm behind you.
Representative Gillette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I maybe have a hybrid between the speakers before me. I've worked for at least a decade in food security and have a ton of farmers in my district, and so I am very passionate about this topic, and normally I would vote for something like this, and I have a similar concern but maybe a little bit of a different perspective than Representative Mercer, that, you know, I just worry that it's not going to target the people that it's intended to target. I'm totally in support of food security and making sure that hungry Montanans have enough to eat. And at the end of the day, I'm worried that this bill doesn't have enough precision to make that happen. And so without that, Mr. Chair, I'm a no.
Representative Beattie.
Thank you, Chairman Jones. Once again, I'm in general agreement with my friend from Billings and also my friend from Gallatin County. What I might recommend as a way to alleviate some of these concerns and to provide proper oversight over this is that the Section E Interim Budget Committee make it a task and a requirement for the Department of Agriculture to report back and provide those definitions that seem to be missing so that we can understand what the reports look like.
I don't think you meant to say Section E, though, but...
It's just that I don't speak very clearly.
Oh, okay.
Now, Section E, it likes taking on a lot of projects, but I already got 8 of them already, so for the interim. So Section C would be who I would be directing that towards.
That might have been what I thought you meant. Do I have additional discussion? Representative Fitzpatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to support the bill. I think it's well-intended. But in all honesty, I'm very skeptical about how likely this project will be successful. And my concerns are not exactly the same as Representative Mercer's, although I do think that he has raised some good questions. But this is Montana. And in Montana, we've got a climate that's not particularly favorable to truck farming. And if you take a look at what we actually produce in this state right now, we can deliver to food banks beef, wheat, and barley. And I realize that when you go to farmers markets that there are folks that are producing vegetables and the like, but for the most part, I think that's a very small-scale hobby kind of a thing. Perhaps it can grow into being something meaningful, but I doubt seriously that you could grow enough produce in the Helena Valley to take care of the need in the Helena food share. But like I said, I'm willing to give these folks a shot at it, and I hope it works, and I hope that 2 years from now I'm wrong. But I also hope that they're not back for more money. Thank you.
Representative Kirk Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate your comments, the comments of the speaker before me. I think one of the things that we as a committee should remember is that over 90% of the food in Montana used to be grown in Montana. That has since changed. We now import most of our food, and I think this bill is part and parcel with a growing movement to shift the balance of that and have more food grown in state. So if you appreciate Montana producers and Montana food, I think this is an excellent bill to vote for.
Okay, at some point we're not changing votes, but I will allow one more discussion and then you called questions. So one more, then she called questions.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a discussion piece. I just have a question, because I do feel like we maybe are reasonably in an agreement by differing degrees, and maybe we could just postpone voting on this. I know. I'm sorry. Okay. That's fine. I wish it would be true, because I actually philosophically agree with the bill and just wish that it had more precision, Mr. Chair, and maybe we can deal with it later, I guess.
Yes, not in the stage of the section where I'm going to take any more delay requests, and I waited 3 weeks for amendments. So question has been called. I am accepting your question. So roll call vote.
Give the girl a candy bar.
Vice Chair Keenan?
No.
Representative Beattie?
Yes.
Representative Binkley?
Yes.
Vice Chair Caffaro?
Yes.
Representative Kirk Carpenter?
Yes.
Representative Falk?
No.
Representative Fitzpatrick?
Yes.
Representative Gillette?
Yes.
Representative Hamilton?
Yes.
Representative Hastings?
Yes.
Representative Hellegard?
Yes.
Representative Hopkins? Representative Keough?
Yes.
Representative Mercer?
No.
Representative Moore?
No.
Representative Knave?
No.
Representative Stuart Paraguay?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Yes.
Representative Regeer?
No.
Representative Schillinger?
No.
Representative Tuss?
Yes.
Representative Wendy Boy?
Yes.
Chair Jones?
Yes. Passes 16 to 7.
Do pass on House Bill 332.
It's been moved to pass on House Bill 332. Representative Beattie.
Thank you, Chairman Jones. I won't rehearse the entire long budget or hearing we had before. I'd just like to emphasize a few things about House Bill 332. First of all, you'll recall that the purpose of the bill is to stabilize health care costs, which are eating into school budgets for reasons, historical reasons and reasons of the way the law is currently structured. This is important in order for us to help address the problem that you have with recruitment and retention of teachers and other school employees across the state. It does ask for a substantial OTO investment of $60 million. I will remind you that just earlier today, that we made a similar such investment of $95 million to shore up pension plans. Now, this is a pretty aggressive program in that it makes this money available, but only for a four-year period, and if the districts don't come together during that period, the money will revert back to the general fund. Amongst the qualifications are that this entity, this trust, be large enough to actually have the financial power to do what we would hope that it would do. So to that end, at least 150 districts with a total of 12,000 employees must gather together in this particular effort. As you will recall from the bill, there are pretty stringent requirements for how this trust must be organized, to include requiring extensive actuarial analysis of its various financial processes. It does have a requirement that the trust operate at with administrative costs below ACA standards. What is unique about this particular trust, that unlike other trusts of this nature, which are unregulated, this bill actually provides for regulation of the trust by the state auditor, who not only will be checking the qualifications of the trust, of the entity that qualifies for this trust, but will have a seat on the board of the trust and will devise by rule sufficient reporting requirements to assess the viability and financial viability of the trust. Now, in closing here, I'll say I want to dispel some misinformation that was provided for us a couple of days ago. This emphatically is not a sweetheart deal for Must. Must doesn't qualify, won't qualify, and whatever, per the bill, whatever entity is qualifies must come into being on or after the 1st of July. This is, I want to also remind you, unlike what the opponent to this bill said, there is a risk-based capital analysis required of the reserve levels required for the trust. That was, it was stated that this was not so. You may look in the bill and find out that that was a misrepresentation of the bill. And finally, I want to emphasize, trusts as they exist now of this nature in law are not regulated. This is becomes a very unique situation whereby we do have state regulation of a trust, and the purpose of that is to ensure that our $60 million investment is well spent. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so as we begin on this, I'd like to suggest we have a couple proponents, a couple opponents, and actually vote sometime. That being said, I'll take questions for a while. Unless you think you're changing hearts and souls at some point, it's just time to vote. Representative Whitney Boyd.
Can I change your heart? Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be a strong yes on this because, you know, sitting in Section E, there's a lot of challenges that we have in this state to try to recruit and retain teachers, and I think this is going to be something that is an investment that's well worth it, and I think that this may, this isn't silver bullet of this thing, but at least it'll give us a chance to at least have some type of attraction to keep our teachers in the state. So I'm going to be a strong yes, Mr. Chairman.
Geez, maybe I spoke way too soon. Oh, Representative Fitzpatrick.
Chairman, I want to thank the sponsor for his opening, but I still lapped you.
That's I'm a sprinter. You're a distance runner.
That's probably not a proponent. Representative Moore.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and good representative. I appreciate the hard work, and really, you have convinced me that there is a dramatic need among a host of school districts that are out there for some mechanism by which health insurance and perhaps some other costs can be addressed. And if at the end of the day, what I wrestle with on this is the magnitude of the appropriation being requested, a little bit confused whether it is really seed money to launch a large health insurance trust. In that regard, I find favor to the extent that there is some confusion, at least in my mind, that some of these funds, if not most, are really just going to supplement the school's health care costs. It gives me concern that we haven't created a mechanism by which that problem has been solved and that they might very well be back seeking more funds in the future. So if this had been a smaller appropriation request that would help seed a health insurance trust and get that launched, I would find more favor. But I found some confusion as to whether it was really supporting ongoing health care costs versus seed money. Thank you.
Additional conversation, Representative Gillette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have probably a little long statements to say, sorry. I was a yes on the House floor. I very much appreciate and recognize that healthcare costs and the stability of what we pay is a big issue. And I get that. It is not a loss on me. And I'm actually in support of this bill, like for the most part, its framework. And at the same time, it just has some, in my mind, critical flaws that I can't get past. I did meet with the bill sponsor yesterday to possibly discuss some amendments, And he said, because I'm short and that I talk too much in committee, that he was not willing to work with me. I'm kidding, obviously. we just didn't quite agree, you know, on the things, which is totally fine. But here's the things that I see in this bill. In no order of priority. The first is really, I worry about the exposure to the districts. So if you remember in the bill, there's a 5-year lock-in period. Should they choose to participate, they're locked in for 5 years. But there's not really any protections for them. So the premiums could double. They could have massive assessments. And there's nothing that they can do about it. There's no protections for the school districts in there. Just so you kind of have a framework to understand this, when you have large assessments or large premium adjustments, like if it doubled for some reason, that what that means is that there's not enough reserves in the plan to address those things. That's what your reserves are for, to help stabilize things. So so that's my first part. The second would be, and it's kind of a minor part to me, but still an issue, is that I really wish that it was housed within the Department of Administration. I do understand that, and know very well from my insurance background, that certainly, you know, the state auditor, like that is, or the insurance commissioner, however you want to frame it, that is a place where they recognize the regulations of insurance, but the real tacit working knowledge of how to manage a plan is really located within the Department of Administration. I mean, we have a screaming state plan, like as in good, like really good state plan for our employees. They know how to manage it. It's dialed in. It's literally nationally recognized for its excellence. And to the extent that they really know how to manage those types of plans, I think that this type of sort of similar plan should be located within the Department of Administration. My third piece, and it, you know, I could probably sort of bend on my thinking around this, but in general, if you were to add, like if you were an insurance plan and you were to add a new product, like let's say a Medicare plan, or you were to move into a different state, all the actuarial modeling would have been done ahead of time. Even if you don't have history in that market, that's okay. There are ways to start to predict what that market might look like, what you know, your makeup of your individuals who would be insured under that plan would look like. Even if you've never been into New Jersey or not, you can model those things. And so for us to spend $60 million without any assurance that we're, like the other representative said, without any assurance that we're going to come back in a subsequent year, they're going to come back in a subsequent year and ask for more millions of dollars, it just seems unreasonable that the legislature is not going to have any prediction about, you know, what the cost might be, what the risk exposure might be. And so in the end, I mean, I would be happy to work on amendments that start to address some of these issues, but without those amendments, Mr. Chair, I'm a no.
Okay. So I'm going to, since I don't have another proponent, I'll do a proponent side, and I'll turn it over to. So one of the very first things, and I don't remember, it was 05 or 07, when I came here, I saw there was a package called SHIP, School Health Insurance, whatever it stood for. But all the schools walked around these basements, and they wore this little picture of a ship, and they said, support this school health insurance program, a trust, a statewide trust for schools. And interestingly enough, while they were downstairs, while they were upstairs, because they didn't want to offend the then governor by saying some of them had concerns, there were folks downstairs telling their representative, not yet, not yet, not yet. And so the ship sank.
but it has showed up a number of different times in that format. There's been proposals since then to join the state health pool, for instance, the one that's managed in DOA. But the problem we've always had is there's an age differential between the groups, interestingly enough. So we actually would bid our state pool up, and the exact argument that the good representative made about people coming and going, they wanted to come and go freely, so effectively come to the state when they were not well, leave when they could get a better deal. When we first looked at the MUST product, and then Mr. Melton had indicated its failings, one of the failings of the early MUST was exactly that. Instead of having requirements that when you came to the product, you had to stay with the product for a while, they shopped it. So when they were sick, they went to MUST. When they were not sick, they left MUST and found AIDS. Whenever they had a high-risk person in their population, all of those things became factored into this new thought process. One was, you can't come and go freely. If you sign up to come, you have to stay for at least 5 years. And if you say, okay, I'm going to go shop, you get out and stay out for 5 years. Two, trusts have failed over the ages, and I too have. We participate in them. Have some experience with them. Trusts have failed if they're too small. So there was requirements put in this that the trust be of substantial size. And interestingly, that money only goes there if there becomes agreement to have the vast majority participate. I was uninterested in this deal, as I will share with you, unless there was a sweep in it. And if you look, all this money comes back to the state if all these characteristics aren't met. And so I was not willing to commit this large amount of money to this process. And I believe it at best 50-50. And to be honest, knowing how well schools get along with each other, the largest prediction I have is the sweep's probably going to run and the money's probably going to come back. Now, I wish them well if this passes. I hope that's not the case. I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but I did watch the ship sink so well. So the other deal that became recognizable was that Section E, the schools, which are about $1 billion a year spender, right, $900 million plus and growing from the state. When we put the formula into law, just like we did with the counties, we installed a cap. So we said you're a 3-year trailing average of inflation capped at 3. So their inflation would be capped, their funding this year at 2.8. And it populations, obviously, if you're growing, you get more. If you're shrinking, you're not. We're seeing some student growth. So we capped the schools at 2.8% ongoing, and then in the second year, I believe they actually hit the top, 3% average, and it can't go above the top. There was significant pressure brought that it was unfair when we were giving raises to our own employees and to others. And if you look at what the average state employee makes at the state and what we put in mattered, it's significant on the bottom or lower percentage size. When we looked at the other sections, none of them, with the exception of the entitlement share, faces that cap. So when they came in and discussed wanting more of an ongoing contribution, we said, no, we don't want it to be part of your ongoing base. So one of the arguments became, well, then can we have an OTO block, a one-time block that's potentially equivalent to that? It's not going to become part of our ongoing base, and it will return. That's where this concept came from. Because of those factors, and because my preference would be to have an OTO, not, and that's somewhat from the, I hate to say it, the employer, the chairman of Probst's point of view, I don't like ongoing base increases. I worry about cash flow in the future. Because it's an OTO that could potentially sweep, set up with sideboards, for me, I was comfortable that not only was this well-structured, it would likely return, to be brutally honest, and that it worked. So for those reasons, I became a proponent of this. My discussion as a proponent. Representative Beattie, you want to close on your bill.
Well, thank you, Chairman Jones, for going well beyond what my close would be. I think it illustrates just the situation that I tried to bring to light when we had the bill hearing before. The structure of school funding is such that we find ourselves in a position where school budgets really are so constrained that they that it is not difficult, it's impossible to deal with escalating costs of the nature that you have with health insurance costs. And to get to Representative Moore's point, there is a bigger problem here. This is not the ultimate solution, although I do believe, as we think our way through this, that this trust will be part of that solution moving forward. To address a couple of other concerns here, the five-year lock is absolutely essential on this for participation, because without that you won't have the stability and you'll find yourself back where we are right now or worse. I'm not as concerned as some are about people coming back for millions of dollars in the future, but I mean obviously that's a possibility. If this trust is well organized, I think that is a relatively remote possibility, but I don't have a crystal ball, so I won't go any further. I do want to make one thing a matter of the record so that I'm not facing ethics charges. I neither called the representative from Gallen County short, nor did I refer to her talking too much or anything of that nature. Now, since she's on the record with a statement like that, I'll let her stand on her own record in that particular area. And so with that semi-attempt at lightheartedness, I close.
And roll call vote.
Vice Chair Keenan?
No.
Representative Beattie?
Yes.
Representative Binkley?
Yes.
Representative Vice Chair Caffaro?
No by proxy.
Representative Kirk Carpenter?
No.
Representative Falk?
No by proxy.
Representative Fitzpatrick?
Yes.
Representative Gillette?
No.
Representative Hamilton?
No.
Representative Hastings?
Yes.
Representative Hellegard?
No.
Representative Hopkins?
Yes.
Representative Keough?
Yes.
Representative Mercer?
No.
Representative Moore?
No.
Representative Nave?
No.
Representative Stewart Paragoy?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
No.
Representative Regeer?
No by proxy.
Representative Schillinger?
No.
Representative Tuss?
Yes.
Representative Windy Boy?
Yes.
Chair Jones?
Yes. Bill fails. 10:30. 13:10. So we need to table. I'd like to offer without objection, a motion to table by reversing the vote. Bill is tabled. 13:10. So members, we will be back in Monday. We have some bills to hear Monday, and we have a potential six-bill drop coming off the floor. We'll see if... No, that's just us. Yeah, so we don't have any bills to hear today, but we will be back in on Monday, let's say 9:30, but please check. If we get too many bills, we may have to do that. Let's plan on... Let's plan on 9 Monday. Let's plan on 9 o'clock Monday. We will have executive action on two Senate bills we've heard. We'll have executive action on this bill that's we just heard from the Speaker, and potentially executive action on some of the other bills. We are starting, the Senate bills obviously could have more time, but the rest of our general bills we are getting sent to us. Potentially Monday is the last day we can amend bills. After that, we're going to have to get more serious about just making the decision on the face of the bill. And so schedule Monday, get your amendments. And with that, we are adjourned.
Yes. Question?
Would you...